Welcome to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. I'm Tom Keene. Daily, we bring you insight from the best in economics, finance, investment, and international relations. Find Bloomberg Surveillance on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the Bloomberg.
Let's talk about trade, shall we? Investors struggling to work out just what was agreed in Argentina. Larry Kudlow called them commitments that both sides would presumably implement. There was also confusion over when the 90-day tariff truce would begin, with Kudlow saying January 1st, which the White House later corrected to December 1st. China has remained largely silent. Ian Shepherdson joins us now, Pantheon Macroeconomics Chief Economist. So, Ian, just what was agreed?
Well, nothing very substantive. The 90-day delay to the implementation of the 25% tariffs was apparently agreed, although that didn't appear in the Chinese statement, nothing else. An agreement to talk and an agreement to pursue a more sustainable trading relationship. But 90 days is nothing like enough, I suspect, to draw up a fundamental change in China's trading relationship with the US. So I guess what we're now hoping for is that in 90 days' time, or preferably before that, the can will be kicked a bit further down the road and we'll continue to talk and we won't ultimately see the imposition of those 25% tariffs. So markets like that bit, but then the closer you look at it, the less of real substance that there is.
We're getting this slow drip feed of more information. There was no mention of autos on the statement released by the United States or the statement released by China. Then the president tweeted about it, and everyone's scrambling to work out what the agreement is exactly. Currently, the tariff is 40%. It's going to be 15% for the rest of the world. Are they talking about coming down to the rest of the world or coming down to zero?
Well, we don't know because China hasn't said. So Xi Jinping and his economic entourage are still traveling and the silence is kind of deafening. So presumably we'll hear something more definitive in due course. But right now we're kind of scrambling. Now, from a macro perspective, I think what markets really wanted to hear was simply that the tariffs wouldn't be imposed January 1, which was the original plan. So we're happy about that. And from a macro perspective, everything else is kind of detailed. Though for individual sectors and for autos in particular, that potential shift from 40% down to 15, possibly, would be an enormously big deal. But right now, there is no hard information on this.
Let's dig into your base case for where growth will be in 2019. Just looking at the Bloomberg ECFC, the function on the Bloomberg terminal, gives me a very quick snapshot of the median estimate of Wall Street for growth projections, forecast 2.6% for 2019. We roll over to 1.9% in 2020. Are you in and around those kind of figures?
The 2019 2.5 I think is reasonable, but it's a year of two halves, because I think in the second half it'll be a great deal slower. And so I'm not with the market for 2020. I think 2020 likely will be quite weak. I wouldn't be surprised to see a mild recession, I stress mild, in 2020. But at this point, that is very contingent on the trade war not flaring up again, and certainly not to the point where we end up with 25% tariffs on the $200 billion currently tariffed to 10%, and certainly not any tariffs on consumer goods, which is another $270 billion. So this is very much a kind of a binary position here, that if we do go down the rabbit hole on tariffs, then the growth outlook will deteriorate in a heartbeat, and that 2.5 number for next year will become extremely difficult to achieve, and it'll be a real mess.
There is always something to worry about, Ian. The latest worry over the last 24 hours once again worries about the yield curve resurfacing. Two-year yields, three-year yields, trading slightly above where the five-year yield is.
Stunning.
Just a little bit of curve inversion for the first time in a long time.
Yeah, no, it is the first time in a long time. I think that, to me, markets have got, shall we say, a little bit ahead of themselves on this disinflation story. You know, I don't buy the idea that we're heading into a materially lower inflation environment in the US, because I think the labor market is so tight that wage growth, which, you know, really is the big driver, is much more likely to head north than south for the foreseeable future. I think people are putting too much emphasis on the impact of the stronger dollar, which, yeah, it pulls down the price of imported everything, but most of the CPI is not imported goods, it's services, it's about wages. And the housing thing as well, which I think has really got a lot of attention, the idea the housing market's rolling over, and it isn't. It's softening. It's not rolling
over.
Well,
what's interesting about this is the dollar has been weaker in the last two sessions. Crude has been firmer in the last two sessions, yet the long end of the Treasury curve is bid. I see that again this morning.
Yeah, because, you know, we need to see the impact, you know, of the dollar, and a couple of days of a dollar weakening doesn't reverse the 7% depreciation in the trade weighted dollar over the last year, and that's really what's been pushing down goods prices.
The yield that we have, what does it signal to our listeners? I think the base feel of all our listeners would be it just means economic slowdown. Is there another signal there?
Well, economic slowdown or lower inflation. And at the moment, I think the market is playing with both of those stories. I think they might be premature on them both because, you know, global growth certainly has lost a bit of its edge. How much of that is due to tariffs and how much of it is due to China's trend slowdown is another question. But the U.S. is strong. Growth here is strong. The labor market here is super tight. We have a 3.7 unemployment rate, and we've got zero real short-term
interest rates. Have you seen wage increases?
Yeah, I mean, wage increases are above. They're above 3% now. You know, a couple years ago,
I get more mail on that, Ian, than anything else.
Yeah, you know,
when guys like you say wages are up, people are like, "Are you out of your mind?" That's what I get.
Wages are up. They're not up as much as a lot of people would like. That's for sure. But especially if you're in a part of the country where the labor market is even tighter than average, and there are some places where unemployment's well below 3%. Wage growth in those places is faster. If you're in a very tight sector like transportation, trucking, there's some big wage gains, but not everywhere, not everyone.
Email just came in from John of Leicester City. No one cares. Talk to Ian about the sale of Newcastle United. Why is it so hard to sell a Premier League football team?
You've got to want to sell it
because
first.
The guy who owns it wants an insane price for it. That's the problem.
Okay, rumor has it you were bidding, but, you know, I mean...
Well, I'd love to, but I'm you know, a few hundred million short.
Does he actually want to sell, Ian? Have you got your hands around that?
If I went to him with $400 million in a black suitcase this afternoon, he would take it. But no one in their right mind is going to pay that much for it.
Let's translate this for the U.S. audience. Is Newcastle United like the Kansas City Royals? And I say that with great respect for the memory of George Brett. Is it a smaller market team where it can't compete with the big Manchester United and the others?
It's all about the ownership because the ownership... Then, you know, if you're owned as Manchester City is effectively by the state of Abu Dhabi, you have a limitless amount of money to spend.
Oh, really?
Newcastle's owned by
that's called the Yankees.
So Mike Ashley, who runs Newcastle United, is a big sort of Main Street retail player as well. He's not very popular in that sense either, Tom. Used to be owned by a gentleman called Freddie Shepherd. These were like the glory days of Newcastle United. In the 90s, Newcastle would break transfer records. They would be that good. They could compete for the best talent on the planet. Things have changed, haven't they, Ian?
Things have changed. We had a negative net spend last year.
Well, are they going to be, is it the right word, relegated? I mean, are they in
probably
risk
not,
of,
because
of,
fortunately there are three teams worse than us, which is quite an achievement, but I think right now that it is the case.
Well, we measure our teams by economists. I mean, I see Blanchflower is one notch below Shepherdson here.
Yep.
Am I right on that?
And West Ham, Steve Major's team, beat Ian 3-0 over the weekend.
Yeah.
Yeah, but Major got the yield call right, so
that's right. That's right.
Okay, we'll leave it there.
We can have an economist ranking of the Premier League table.
Oh, we should. We should get t-shirts made. Surveillance tour, and on the back of all the teams in the Economist, it's identified. Who's identified with Crystal Palace?
Oh, I don't know. Although we did have a listener write in about Crystal Palace recently, so there is a Crystal Palace
Michael
fan
Barr
out there listening.
Be Crystal Palace, Michael Barr, would that be good?
Well, I used to love the Pistons when they played at the Palace, but that's another story.
That's another story completely. Ian Shepherdson, thank you so much, particularly for your comments through the morning on the protests and the press conference in France. It's widely known that John Farrow and I don't get along, but contrary to the belief... We actually almost listen to each other. We rarely talk, but we listen to each other in the break. And Ira Jersey with us from Bloomberg Intelligence, just wonderful on bonds. And this is the bond interview of the day. I was thunderstruck by something that John Farrow said, which is it's not where the yield curve is or all these dynamics. It's the way we're getting there. It just seems so odd right now. How odd is it?
So the headlines... aren't basically keeping up with the with what the market's doing. Right?
The market is someone saying buy a bond, yield lower, price higher.
Correct, and you wouldn't expect that given what's happened with equities, given some of the headlines that came out over the weekend with maybe an easing of trade tensions, even though that seems to be walking back a little bit. But you would have expected, at least I would have expected, some steepening and probably bear steepening. So basically, 10 10-year yields, 30-year yields selling off, but instead we're getting exactly the opposite. So why is that? Well, that's the market telling you that they're skeptical that economy and the economy and inflation are likely to be significantly higher in the future than they are now. But I mean, these moves are not massive, right? We're talking about a few basis points. It's not like this is a major
trend.
Yeah,
but on a percent, I'm going to do my Stan Fisher here. On a percentage change basis, these are big deals. We've gone from 22 to 13 beeps on the 210 spread. That's not massive.
So if you think about it from a total return perspective, depending on how you size your risk, if you did that in, say, you know, buying 50 million of one and 10 million of another, then you wind up with, you know, reasonable returns, but it's not going to make your year, right? That's not what something that's going to make your year. But, you know, if you had that trade right, you did well, obviously.
I don't know how many people were,
which I think might be one of the reasons that this is occurring, in steepeners.
The only thing that made my year was when John Farrell canceled his two-week vacation. That's what the British do.
Do you know it's our one-year anniversary today? Did you know that?
Wow.
Is it?
I didn't get you guys a card or
one,
a
1 year on Bloomberg Surveillance Radio together.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. No cake, nothing. I thought they'd bring us a cake, but nothing. I didn't get anything. Don't I get a reward for this? For lasting a year. Ira, the why is really interesting. I just want to have a look at what we're now sort of signaling for people, because I think for a lot of equity investors, they've been conditioned to worry about this a great deal. Inversion from front to belly, so from sort of the 2 year space into the 5 year, is actually quite normal at this kind of time. It's quite normal for a lot of people to be thinking about, just to help them get their heads around it. That's what you expect to happen first.
Correct.
And then several years later is really when you start to see the economy roll over.
Right. And more importantly, I think, is when you wind up getting the whole curve inversion, right? So when twos to 10, to the 2 year to the 10 year inverts, that's kind of been the signal in the past that said, 18 months later, you expect a recession. But that only happens in this environment if the Fed goes too far. So right now, we're pricing for a December hike. We're pricing for one hike in 2019. Unless the Fed goes more than that, then inverting that whole curve will probably be avoided. That being said, and as Tom noted, you know, the curve has flattened quite a lot the last couple of days. And that's really something that I think some people are going to be concerned with in the long term. But it's also saying, I think at some level, that we think that the Fed is going to stop. And we do think that at some point in the next 10 years, we're going to see a recession.
So this raises a big question for a lot of people. I know some people will be trying to game this, and it's incredibly difficult to do. We're starting to think about when the next rate cut comes. And I'm not talking about in the next 12 months, but when you start to think out where the next rate cut comes, you're looking across the Treasury curve to work out where in the curve looks cheap relative to the idea that, say, the 5 year ultimately becomes where the Fed funds rate is, because that maturity will be what you want to buy when they sort of cut rates. So where are we thinking on the curve that you think looks cheap, where really in several years' time is going to be most likely impacted by a rate cut?
So when you look at the overnight index swap market, which is based on where the Fed funds rate is expected to be at some period of time, we're not pricing that right now basically at all. But we're basically saying in 2019, the market's saying in 2019, the Fed's going to stop. We're going to stay there for years, right? And that's one reason why you can have this flat curve from 2 year to 5 year. There is some chance maybe in 2020 or 2021 that they'll cut, but the market tends not to price for that until there's a little bit more visibility into things that far out. The market tends to be pretty good at the next 2 years, not so good when you get significantly farther.
Are all these gyrations away from full faith and credit? Is corporate acting the same way? Yields in?
Yields in corporates have come down a little bit, but that's mainly because of the rate move. It's not because of spreads. So corporate spreads haven't really moved a whole heck of a lot recently.
So what are bond portfolios doing right now? You know, what's a typical total return fund manager doing besides aging?
Yeah, so a lot of people I think had pretty poor years just because of what's happened, in the market with significant sell-off. So earlier in the year, a lot of total return managers did very well because they were underweight duration, they might have been short interest rates, and when interest rates went up, they did very well, but they kept that view instead of reversing it.
Yeah.
But you look at things like speculative positioning in Treasury futures, and everyone was so massively incredibly short. In fact, just weeks ago, they hit the shortest ever. Now they've cut that short by almost half.
Don't be a stranger. This was great. This will be out on podcast. Ira Jersey with your bond briefing for the day. This is just great for Global Wall Street. John, this is great. Kevin Book writes in English on oil at Clearview Energy, and he calls it Greenspan on the Danube.
I love that.
Greenspan on the Danube. What we're going to see out of Vienna, and Anne-Marie Horden with that great Saudi Arabian interview earlier today, we would not be surprised to find a brain-twisting, circumlocutive jumble of word jazz from the clarinet is similar to some of the more abstruse statements that former Fed Chairman Alan Greenspan issued during his tenure. Kevin, that's a great way to put it. Within the verbiage, what are we going to look for from the cartel?
Good morning, Tom. I think the number is what we're looking for, and a number that won't inflame President Trump is why it comes in code. 1.4 million is, I think, a pretty consensus expectation for what it'll take to balance the market. It helps to have Canada pulling oil off the market itself. It helps to have a slightly tighter Iran supply picture showing up in the numbers. But 1.4 is what we're looking for, a 1.4 coordinated cut.
Kevin, to be clear here, you think that press release could be for an audience of one?
Well, it's never just for an audience of one, but I think it's going to be worded with a particular wariness for that one.
That's fascinating to me that the president has this much impact on OPEC, the cartel, not just the Saudis. How will the other individual groups, countries, nations, respond to the pressure the Saudis are under to do this?
As you know, it's never easy. There's always big contributions from the kingdom and then pennies from some of the others. In this particular case, it's also a question of persuading Russia to stay in the game. For Russia, right now, this is still looking like good economic self-interest. But as you start to see the peeling away of Qatar and start to ask whether or not this is really going to stay in Russia's long-term self-interest, it has to do with whether or not there's a new regional realignment taking place and whether Russia's other economic goals, including selling nuclear power plants and natural gas and other aspects of their portfolio to Turkey and other partners in the region, start to predominate. For now, it looks like coordination. A high five goes a long way towards setting expectations.
So, Kevin, a high five, but it's easy to high five when you're boosting output at record amounts. I mean, we've got record production in Russia, record production in Saudi Arabia. What would you consider a material cut? Going back to the levels of before the summer, going back to the levels of earlier this year, what would a real cut be for OPEC?
Well, the real concern is that they might undercut relative to where demand might take us. We have a fairly bearish demand outlook just thinking about the frictional impacts of the nascent trade war. It's hard to prove. We can't see the investments that don't happen. We can't see the demand that didn't materialize. And downward revisions are the stuff of oil analysis, right? But still, sorry, go on.
No, it's fine. I'm listening. I'm loving it, Kevin Book. But the issue, Kevin, for me, is 6 weeks ago, we were talking about a bond market that was going to go to 3.5% 10-year. 8 weeks ago, you tell me exactly, oil was going to $100 a barrel. These fancy people show up in Vienna, and am I right that they're showing up within a cacophony of instability? I mean, do they have any clue what the underlying microeconomics are?
I think that nobody's particularly comfortable with the instability of an unsynchronized global growth picture. The idea of oil roaring ahead as we all go straight into the, you know, the 3.5-4% sugar juice GDP high of the United States, that's over, right? Mm-hmm. So we have such an incredibly strong GDP linkage in the non-OECD. In addition to that, there's growing price sensitivity in some of those non-OECD consumers for crude. So when you start to see China respond to high prices, when you see currency-adjusted acquisition costs tamping down demand, when you see effective trade stagnation, if not outright war, starting to crimp investment, those are the warning signs that make you think, gosh, you know, maybe maybe things are a little weaker out there for oil than we thought.
What happens with U.S. shale off the back of the OPEC decision this week?
Well, the brakes are off a lot worse than the accelerator. The problem with shale is that the latency takes a while on the downside. We saw what happened in 2014. It was, 6 to 9 months in some formations before things really slowed down, and how quickly it can zip back to answer the call from demand when it resurfaces. So I think you probably are in some ways blessed by the constraints coming out of some of the most prolific producing areas like Permian. At this point, it's not that easy to get the additional crude to market. That makes some of the cost an issue. But once those wells start, people are going to run those wells. That's
Kevin,
the nature of U.S. production.
Just to be clear, though, the rig count has never recovered from the 2014 collapse, has it? Is this a regions that are doing more with less?
Absolutely. It didn't need to recover because they're getting more out of the ground with fewer rigs. Doing more with less is terrific. Higher efficiency wells are terrific. But remember, those wells run, right? We don't shut stuff off. Spare capacity isn't for U.S. producers.
What is the likelihood or probability, I should say, of revisiting $29 a barrel? I have not asked that question, folks, since the dash to $100 a barrel. But who says we're at stasis here? I mean, review how we got to $30 a barrel. And could it happen right now?
Well, yes, of course. The oil market has a wide range, and it's demonstrated. I mean, it's operatic in its range, all the way from the highs to the lows.
Yeah.
A thrilling show. But look, the reality is that at this point, we still have some fairly robust consumption going on in the world. It isn't obvious that you're all the way down to the 2014 bleakness. In 2014, you also had the kingdom unwilling to take action and to muscle up and say, all right, let's cut. They thought they would flood, and flood they did. As production continued to flow out of the U.S. producers, the kingdom didn't stop. Now they've taken a more activist role.
Kevin, I want to hit the final point that we haven't touched on just yet. I had no idea that Canada could join the cutting crew. How is that possible, that they even have the ability to do this, to tell a region effectively to shut it down a little bit?
Well, there's a lot to be said for what it means to be Canadian and to be so heavily dependent in the Western Canada sedimentary basin on the fruits of production. These are the kinds of actions that are dire. But when you saw differentials to WTI, $40 and up for West Canada Select, I think that speaks to why there's a sense of intervention. Technically, the Canadian people are owners, stakeholders to the oil production in their country. There's tax flows. There's other secondary revenue streams. It's the kind of thing that it doesn't feel quite like capitalism, but then again, not much does sometimes.
Kevin, it's been hugely valuable. Kevin Book, thank you so much with Clearview Energy with a briefing on the vicissitudes, as they say, of oil. We are thrilled and strung here on Bloomberg Surveillance today with Emma Ross Thomas driving forward all of our Brexit coverage. Emma, I was thunderstruck by the scathing critique of the former governor of the Bank of England against Prime Minister May. The headline of the Bloomberg opinion piece, May's Brexit deal is a betrayal of Britain. Did you see this coming from Mervyn King?
The criticism that is already sort of out there on both sides of the Brexit debate, which is that this deal, not only is it the worst of both worlds, but that it sort of somehow traps the UK within the EU's orbit. And that really, it's all from the very beginning, this was about the Irish backstop and, the problem of how to deal with the Irish border. And that is what we're still fighting about. And even, we had in Parliament yesterday, we had Ollie Robbins who negotiated this thing. And even he was sort of saying, yeah, the backstop's uncomfortable.
Yeah.
If we end up going into this, it's not great. And, that really is why Theresa May is on course to lose the vote, according to all indications, that she's going to lose the vote next week because, they've negotiated something that a lot of people on both sides are seeing as a trap.
Buried in the heat of this essay is a single paragraph citing Paul Krugman, the Nobel laureate, that the analysis of the Bank of England is correct in that these are long-term effects. The Brexiteers would say these are one-off effects that the United Kingdom can recover from. Discuss that debate right now in the United Kingdom. Is there a permanence to Brexit effects?
Right, so I suppose the debate here very much is about whether forecasts are worth anything. You know, we had Project Fear with the referendum campaign in 2016. The Bank of England came out. Everyone came out and said that, you know, a vote to leave would have disastrous consequences for the economy. That didn't play out, at least immediately, partly, of course, because Brexit hasn't actually happened yet. And so really the debate here is about how reliable those forecasts are, and also about, you know, the Bank of England weighing in to what is essentially a political debate. And I think that's what was interesting about the Mervyn King comments, is his sort of saying, you know, he kind of was hinting that the Bank of England has got a bit politicized, really. And of course, you know, Carney would say that they're not forecasts. You know, in fact, last week he was sort of calling forecasts the F word. He's saying these aren't forecasts. These are scenarios. These are, you know, possibilities. And in fact, even this morning he was sort of saying this is not a forecast. It's not very likely. But Carney this morning was defending him and saying, you know, the result of 2 years of work and standing by them.
I'm wondering if you could describe, in your opinion, or based on sort of listening to the media and to the experts, why did Lord King decide to write this now and not 6 months ago?
I wish I knew the answer to that. But what we have been, I don't know the answer to that, but what we have been seeing recently is that people who have been reluctant to speak out, people who normally wouldn't speak out, we're now sort of 100 odd days away from Brexit Day, this historic event that will, you know, change the course of, you know, the economy, diplomacy, politics for generations, that people are sort of starting to come out and say, you know, they've read the small print. You know, that deal, that withdrawal deal took a lot of digesting. You know, it was this massive document. And, you know, it took days for people to actually realize the implications of this, the legal implications of this. And now I think what's happening is that people from, you know, public and semi-public figures are coming out and saying, you know, we've really got to stop this. And the real argument for backing the deal, for backing Theresa May's deal, is, and this is the argument, you know, that business is coming out with, is, you know, they just want continuity, they want an end to the uncertainty. And any of the sort of more, if you sort of scratch the surface of the deal, you know, people are tending to come out with arguments that are more about how this actually is not a terribly good deal for the UK, how it is quite lopsided, and how, as I say, that sort of it risks trapping the UK into the EU's orbit without a way out.
Well, to use a bad analogy, you know, you can break the glass, but you can't hold back the water. It's great to have these comments at the very last minute. Mark Carney has even kind of mocked Lord King, hasn't he?
Well, I mean, Carney was sort of defending his work. And I think Carney, you know, is no stranger to criticism. He, you know, the pro-Brexit camp here has been very critical of Carney from the beginning. And I think, you know, what we've seen is kind of a continuation of that, really kind of justifying the bank's work and its independence.
Emma, one final question. There's so much going on here. What will be the carry forward of Mervyn King's essay? Does it just float off? Is it an interesting essay from a bright, bright, experienced guy? Or does it get traction with the other media? And does it get traction within this heated debate in Britain?
I mean, I suppose what we're seeing is it's a question of critical mass, isn't it? As more and more people come out and analyze this deal. And, you know, just now we've had Unite, the union, you know, very big union, has just come out and said that they're also going to be lobbying lawmakers to vote against it. And so I think what's interesting is it's not sort of one voice, but it's the voices across the spectrum, across the Brexit debate. You know, remember Joe Johnson. You know, we've had, you know, the Boris Johnson and Joe Johnson on both sides of the debate are coming out against this deal. I think that's what's interesting, is that across walks of life, across disciplines, you know, you're seeing people saying this is actually a really bad deal.
It's been wonderful. Thank you so much. Emma Ross Thomas, off of our London desk, of course, and really doing all of our Brexit coverage and organizing that for us. Thanks for listening to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. Subscribe and listen to interviews on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, or whichever podcast platform you prefer. I'm on Twitter at Tom Keene. Before the podcast, you can always catch us worldwide on Bloomberg Radio.